running with his dad every year, specifically the sense of responsibility and proficiency they display when it comes to breaking down a buck and using every possible part of the animal. They maintain an understanding of the local deer population and the importance of culling the overpopulated species. He and his dad know the satisfaction that comes from providing one's own sustenance in a conscientious way, whether it's venison or turnips. They deal directly with the bounty of Mother Nature, cutting out all of the middlemen and women, and thereby a lot of pollution and carbon footprint. John was deer hunting with some friends in Oklahoma, and he almost came to blows with them over the way they processed their animals. "They took the back straps and the hindquarters, and that was it," he said. John told them, "There's at least 60 pounds of meat you're wasting, leaving it like that." To which the friends replied, "Oh, where are your Birkenstocks?" George laughed and pointed out that using nature economically was hardly a liberal notion. John was defending a purely frontier, agrarian morality, simply that nothing should go to waste whenever possible, especially with regard to a local game mammal whose life had been sacrificed so that the hunter's family might prosper. This sort of economy is literally conservative, and I, a very liberal thinker, am all for it. I do love the smell of nuance in the morning. While it's rare that I would be with someone who would make the statement, "I love to kill animals," I do have friends and an uncle who would say, "I love to hunt," in much the same way that I love to fish, but would not say, "I love to kill fish." They are simply regular, consistent hunters, a practice which comes with a strict set of moral rules. My family loves fishing, and my folks freeze and then eat the fish we catch in Minnesota all year long. My uncle learned to hunt from his dad and uncle when he was a teenager. He's a retired school teacher now, and my aunt is a retired librarian, so they weren't exactly swimming in income. Hunting has always been a way for him to provide plenty of the highest possible quality organic meat for his family, while spending many hours silently communing with nature. He's just a very good guy, and I powerfully admire his discipline and commitment to the morality of both hunting and fishing. Speaking with John that day reminded me of the overwhelming lack of nuance in the national gun conversation. How people like him and my uncle exist in a sphere wherein their gun ownership as hunters makes perfect sense, as much sense as owning a fishing pole. But that is only one facet of a many-sided story. Both John and my uncle also own and maintain firearms for self-defense, which is another ball of wax entirely. A body cannot shoot up an elementary school with a fishing pole. I heard something strange on the trail several yards behind me and turned around to see a good-sized mountain goat striding doggedly in our direction. Now, first of all, I had only seen these stately critters from more of a distance earlier in this trip. This fellow was approximately the size of a small pony, but built a little more like a 1970s tight end. With its rangy stride and tufted white coat, it exhibited a strong Muppet vibe, if Muppets could lower their heads and butt you off the mountain. There wasn't much room into which we could clear off the trail, maybe one body width, and as we stepped aside to let the goat pass, I felt a combination of thrill at his proximity and unease at his proximity. The 8 to 10 inch curved black horns atop his snow-white head had something to do with the fact that the three of us newbies held our breath. Once the goat had passed us by, picking up his pace into a little jog, Jeff muttered a quiet, "Yeah, I thought so," at the volume you use to make your friends laugh while remaining absolutely certain that the goat won't hear you and abruptly come back and get in your face to ask, "You say something?" I asked John if that handsome goat would be good eating, to which he replied, "Come November, after a full season of grazing, it would be pretty good, especially in a cast-iron skillet drizzled in butter with just a pinch of brown sugar and baked to 135. Otherwise, like now, they're still shedding their winter coats and recovering from a pretty harsh winter, very thin and not much fat on them. They'd be dry and gamey." This probably sounds funny to most of us, but just like I think that wood shop and welding and baking and sewing and so forth should be taught in our public schools as imperative parts of the curriculum of life, I also think it would do our society a world of good were we made to participate in a hunt. This would include the competent processing or butchering of the kill. Similarly, I believe that if we were all made to participate in the raising and subsequent butchering of a farm animal, it would quickly foment a massive shift in our national agricultural policies, because it would serve as a poignant reminder of how this particular food stream works, like what parts of the animals we use and what happens to the waste. For that matter, shouldn't we all also have some knowledge of where all of our waste goes? We really are inured in modern American society from being required to face not only how our food is produced and delivered to us, but then how our domestic waste is transferred back into the natural cycle of decay. I take great satisfaction in cleaning the fish I've caught. My dad taught me to do it 40 years ago, and I love how clean of a system it is. In a Minnesota lake setting that appears as crisp and inviting as any beer commercial you've seen, we catch healthy panfish, and then with a fillet knife and a relatively skilled pair of hands, glean all of the muscle from the fish before adding the remainder of the fish's guts to the compost pile. Chapter 5. Rafting the Flathead River. By now, we had experienced a rather overwhelming amount of scenery, weather, mostly chill and lovely, and walking. It was high time for these three amigos to get out of our hiking boots and into a relaxing river raft. Or so I thought. We met our rowing guide, Demi, along Moccasin Creek, just outside the park, where we all lent a hand lifting our raft into the calm stream that fed into the river. The 16-foot inflatable rubber raft was designed to carry up to 10 passengers, but we were just the three of us plus Demi. Since we lacked a full complement of rowers, she attached an oar rig high up on the stern, which would allow her to steer the boat with much more power than she would normally bear. I sat in the front starboard corner, right, with George in the front port corner, left, and Jeff just behind him, in his lee. I'd say we were in the bow, but I'm not certain that rafts have a bow. As we gently propelled ourselves from the trickling creek into the middle fork of the Flathead River, Demi steered us into the current and we were off, gliding through the scenery on this small, ridiculously picturesque river that none of us, except our guide, could ever have imagined would soon plunge us into veritable maelstroms of hell. I paddled along, dazzled by the ever-shifting play of light and color in every square yard of the river, enraptured by every inch of the experience as our threesome chatted gaily. This was when Demi said, "Okay, let's start getting ready for Fluffy Kitten Rapids." For decades, friends had been insisting that I should really try my hand at some river rafting, that I would love it to bits. This suggestion was predicated upon the knowledge that I hail from a family of boat people, even beyond our yearly fishing trips. Whenever we can, weather permitting, we get in a boat and get out on a lake or river to engage in fishing, water skiing, tubing, or meditative sightseeing, depending on who's at the tiller. It's a big family, so it might be any combination of siblings, aunts, uncles, and cousins. On top of that, for most of my life, I have maintained an enthusiasm for paddling a canoe, which manifested itself powerfully when I built 2 cedar strip wooden canoes by hand about 14 years ago. So ironically, the very reason it occurs to people to urge river rafting upon me that I love to paddle about in boats is also why I never get around to it. If I have time that I could otherwise devote to a rafting trip, I have likely already arranged to be fishing, canoeing, or building a boat or other goodness in my shop. On paper, rafting just never sounded that different from what we were already doing. Listener, let me please advise you that it is indeed mighty different, and incredibly so. Take the feeling of conditional security that comes with the proper operation of a watercraft, and douse it in a bucket of the stomach-churning exhilaration of a roller coaster. Imagine that log ride at a theme park, but then take it literally off the rails and occasionally plunge it beneath the mighty surging veins of current in a crystal green, freezing cold river. I'll pause to point out that despite the aforementioned thrills, river rafting, even those routes described as whitewater, is an extremely safe outdoor sport, logging less than 1 fatality in 100,000 participants on average. I'm no adrenaline junkie, but I do think that there is some value in experiencing a certain level of risk when visiting the outdoors. As part of my personal campaign to prevent myself from becoming a fully soft modern urbanite, I regularly explore places and activities outside of my comfort zone, as it were. By planning such trips, which for me have recently included hiking, cycling, skiing, running, fishing, rafting, and canoeing, I am able to test the limits of what my body can endure and how it will perform in various circumstances. This profoundly affects my health and my self-confidence and my knowledge of navigating my existence, both at home and abroad. As the world emerges from the widespread lockdowns of COVID-19, I think it's especially important to reestablish our relationship with risk, lest it become reduced to something resembling agoraphobia. Thanks to an understandable reticence toward getting out into the world during the pandemic, I would not want any further timidity to set in with myself and others merely because we had not ridden a horse for so long. Seeking acceptable levels of risk, I think, is a great way to get back on the horse and reclaim our individual powers. It was not yet clear how acceptable today's level of risk would be. The ironically named Fluffy Kitten Rapids is the first of approximately 16 sets of rapids, varying in intensity from Class 2 to 3, that have more accurate satisfying names like Can Opener, Bone Crusher, and Toilet Bowl. Demi did a terrific job of making us comfortable with the approach of each pulverizing scenario, and then steering the raft with her oars to keep us safe while simultaneously working in concert with the river to thrill our pants off. The orientation of enormous boulders beneath the surface is what causes the mighty flow of virgin glacier melt to behave in every goofy way you might imagine. My favorite ones involved the currents plunging straight down suddenly, then doing a bit of a backflip. So as we dove straight toward the river bottom, tons of brisk water washed back across us in an attempt to swipe us clean off the boat. The breathless, blinking elation I was feeling was not too dissimilar from past live music experiences, when I had felt lost in the pleasurable sensations evoked by dancing and feeling the blood coursing through my limbs, although those moments were always assisted by one intoxicant or another. The gusto to be savored on the raft, however, required no help whatsoever. The commitment required was so encompassing that we could only spare one another the occasional glance, grinning complicit smiles, in the knowledge that we were all in for the duration of this ride. Shouting laughter to the point of screaming punctuated each one of these thrilling and joyful obstacles, followed by sucking inhalations and exclamatory triumphs of one sort or another once the waters calmed yet again to a friendlier behavior. At one point early on, George removed his glasses and reached inside of his life jacket to place them securely in the breast pocket of his shirt. Evincing a gingery charisma that was part John Denver, part Edgar Winter, flipping the sopping locks off his forehead, he nodded sagely at me, to which I responded, "Smart." Back into the fray we plunged. As we were then coming clear of the next churning chaos and the gallons of water cascaded off of us, I looked to my left to see George's glasses now sitting impossibly on the round inflated side of the raft behind his rear end, just as Jeff casually noticed them and nimbly grabbed them before the wild torrents could return to sweep them away. He had them. The entire moment was pregnant with magical reality. Fully through the looking glass, / opening credits of Land of the Lost type stuff. I mean, everything was already more twinkly and delightful than my senses could fully comprehend before we saw George secure his glasses in his pocket. The atmosphere was such that if you had told me the river had prized the eyeglasses from beneath his vest, sluiced them into his gaping mouth as we dove into the depths, and manipulated them through his body until, as we crested the river top once again, he neatly pooped them out of his bottom, complete with a cork-popping noise, I would merely have stated, "Aha! I was wondering." The actual fact, then, that the serpentine mischief of the waves somehow transported the spectacles from their safe burrow to see them puckishly alight before Jeff, only to taunt him before snatching them away, to ruin George's mojo and subsequently our good time, shifted our expedition firmly into the realm of fairy. Or so they thought, because these river dryads had not met our Jeff Tweedy. Sure, it might seem as though Jeff had merely looked down in front of him at a fortuitous time and had the wherewithal to pick up a pair of eyeglasses in peril. I would have sworn it was not a big deal, but a perfectly ordinary feat, requiring the barest minimum of strength, coordination, and cognition. But apparently I was wrong. As Jeff pointed out to us repeatedly, for the remaining couple of hours we paddled on the flathead, it was a deceptively heroic achievement on his part. We weren't quite suitably astonished, in his view, and we might just want to think again about the athletic prowess he exhibited in his golden grab, reflexes that any self-respecting cat would have been glad of. And like that. George was certainly grateful to have his eyeglasses rescued, but by the time we had heard Jeff recount his hyperbolic blow-by-blow commentary more than twice, I think George would have gladly rather spent the balance of the trip half-blind. To be honest, George is precisely the kind of guy who could handle a ramble through the woods without his glasses. In fact, he'd likely come out of it with a pithy 3,500-word essay about how it took losing his glasses to bring the plight of the American honeybee into focus, or some such jewel. All three of us were pretty well-traveled, thanks to our respective vocations, but I dare say George's work as a journalist occasionally found him in much more precarious real-life scenarios than the venues where Jeff and I were generally transported to perform for people or cameras. Whether he was sleeping alone in a Fresno homeless camp, or under the stars with Texas Border Patrol guards, or swimming in a Sumatran river so full of monkey shit that it laid him sick in bed for weeks, George's writing assignments regularly took him much farther from the realm of material comfort that we all usually enjoyed. Think about it like this. When Jeff and I travel abroad to do our work as entertainers, the exchange of goods delivered, our music / mirth / medicine, to the recipients, audiences buying tickets plus beer slash merch slash bratwurst, is much more immediately realized than when George travels to gather experience and evidence to fuel or support whatever he happens to be writing, whether it's an essay for The New Yorker or a short story or what have you. In the case of a writer like him, the money does not depend directly upon the travel. With Jeff and me, however, if we don't get to the church on time, nobody gets paid. Therefore, we are ridiculously pampered by people whose income depends on our successful conveyance from place to place. And so if they could, the promoters would lay our pale, fleshy bottoms on climate-controlled velvet pillows and see us carried gently from place to place so as to ensure the best possible chance of seeing their own paycheck. George, however, is usually on his own, and he needs to be to successfully blend into the background of whatever scene he's scrutinizing. His destination and the people there are his artistic quarry. He cannot let his appearance or his rental car or any other superficial signal betray to his potential subjects that he is going to capture them with his eyes, ears, and heart, then represent them with compassion and accuracy as best he can when he writes his intended piece. As a person who worked for many years as a laborer, I am now painfully aware of my spotless new white Ford Expedition when I pull into my own wood shop and park among the vehicles of my employees and neighbors, which are rarely new or spotless. I have a well-beaten Ford F-250 that lives at the shop, and when I drive it around town, I'm instantly aware of the difference in the way my fellow motorists and pedestrians perceive me. George seems to have developed a quiet mastery of this ability to disappear amongst the people, which allows him to travel far off the beaten path in search of his literary gold. What gave him this spark for adventure? Was his innate curiosity somehow also connected to his tendency to embroider into his writing a sense of empathy? This thought occurred to me as we got to know our guide John better and better each day. Although we were from very different upbringings in vastly disparate parts of the country, we found that we had much more in common than not, and we could agree on most common sense issues. Then again, we were, all four of us, cisgender, middle-aged white guys in America. One wouldn't have to travel very far at all outside of our country before looking back to find us appearing indistinguishable from each other in the middle distance. It stands to reason, then, that from the greater distance of Asia, the Middle East, or South America, we would just appear among the masses of rich white people who are not starving. One would need to travel all the way to us and experience us in the context of our lives before being able to fully take the measure of us as individuals in each of our particular circumstances. By the same token, I feel like it's important for everyone to travel to other countries and experience the ways in which we humans are all the same, as well as the ways in which our cultures differ. When we can see our fellow humans in other parts of the world doing their best to do their work and love their families and have fun together one way or another, it makes empathy much easier to come by. For the many instances in which we can't travel to foreign lands, we have documentary films and writers like George to help us relate to all of humanity. Later in the raft ride, with only a few rapids remaining, we entered a large eddy in which the swirling current slowed to feel more like a pond for a few dozen yards. Demi announced that this was an ideal place to jump in the river, should we care to feel the thrill of swimming in 48-degree pristine water that had, until extremely recently, been frozen in a glacier a ways upstream. This sounded pretty great. She sold it well. But then again, we were pretty wiped out from the many rapids we had braved thus far, and maybe we didn't need to jump into the freezing, opalescent drink. Jeff spoke first, citing once again his Homeric accomplishment with the eyeglasses and the toll that particular decathlon had exacted upon his reserves. He said, not unwisely, that he would pass on jumping into frigid water and then suffering the consequence of sodden clothing for the duration of the journey. This was a fair point. We were by no means dry by this juncture of the trip, but a full soaking in the river did seem perhaps a step too far. I was about to voice my agreement with this vote for less swimming and more comfort when George turned to me and veritably twinkled his eye. It really twinkled, veritably. He said, "Let's do it." And I said, "Of course. Hell yes." The river was quite deep in this segment, so our dives yielded no bottom, nor did our swimming about above and below the surface. For a long few moments, I was actually lost in the utterly exhilarating sensation, so new and stimulating it was. Cold water wakes you up to begin with, so to apprehend that bodily jolt that's better than the best triple espresso in the midst of the most picturesque water, rocks, forest, sky, scenery imaginable, in the company of two loving brother friends, like sister wives but with fewer babies, was not only a trip highlight, but a life highlight. I'll never forget that sensory pinnacle of our trip to Glacier National Park, and more important, I'll never forget the inherent lesson in George's insistence that we say yes to life as hard as we could. Chapter 6. Grinnell Glacier Hike. This is the big one. Everything has been leading up to this. John had planned the week so that our distances and inclines gradually increased in difficulty, in order to condition us for today's hike to the Grinnell Glacier. Covering 10.5 miles round trip and a rise of 1,600 feet, we art boys had our work cut out for us. If that wasn't clear already, it really hit home when John huddled us up in the parking lot and delivered a sedate guide speech. This hike is going to differ from the others in that it will put us more than 2 hours from definitive medical care, which means that this is a backcountry hike as opposed to a frontcountry hike. He went on to basically explain that he would establish a sphere of acceptable risk, as in, "You kids stay near me," and that we would all now agree to trust his guidance when it came to navigating hazards, from crossing snowy slopes to pushing through fatigue to possible bear encounters. We all agreed, with minimal wisecracking, and we mothered each other through an assessment of our clothing layers, since we were starting in shorts and t-shirts but would end up in the snow on a glacier. After double-checking our stores of water and food, we set off. It was about 7 a.m., which meant we had few other hikers with whom to share the trail, and those who were there were as serious about this endeavor as we were. In other words, nobody was shouting badger. The first section of the hike required us to perambulate through a shady aspen forest, which bordered first Swift Current Lake, then Lake Josephine, and the conditions could not have been more idyllic. As we approached the far end of Lake Josephine, a charming lake boat came cruising up to a dock to unload 20 or so passengers. John informed us that we could have taken the boat from a lodge at the far end of Swift Current Lake at the start of the jaunt instead of walking the first couple of miles. As I've said, we Offermans love a boat ride. No matter where we are in the world, if we're deciding between two routes and one of them includes a ferry, then the decision is made. I think it's because we're a hard-working people, and we don't vacation perhaps as much as we ought to. So, when what amounts to simply our commute happens to get us out on the water of a lake, river, or bay, where we can take in some scenery and feel the breeze and smell the rich, heady mix of diesel fuel and fish, Well, it feels like we're getting away with something. The fact that on many ferries one can get some sort of grub and a beer also does not damage our affection. Despite my boatist leaning, I was glad we had walked through the aspens, firstly just for the pure enjoyment of the setting. Hearing the morning birdsong while ambling along with friends, admiring clear lake waters through trees. On top of that, I have this stubborn propensity for being a completist. For example, if I say to my bunkmates in a prison camp that I can, say, eat 50 eggs, even if it causes me great physical distress, you best believe I'm gonna eat 50 damn eggs, with no cheating either. This has proven to be extremely the case with me and hikes for which I have a map and pertinent statistics. For some reason, I apparently take it as a challenge when an app tells me that such and such moderate route is 7 miles and it should take 3 hours to finish. It's not that I want to race the suggested time, I just want to feel like I've consumed the entire feature, which also means that I eschew any proffered shortcuts. So, if our guide takes us on a 10.5-mile hike, and we were to spend 2 miles sitting on our duffs in the extravagant pleasure of a boat, I would feel somehow cheated. Megan, my bride, loves this quality in me when she says, "Can we go back now? I have a blister." And a look of intense consternation falls upon my mug, as I have to gently talk myself out of the idea that my wife is asking me to fail. Once the path took us above the forest and the lakes, we entered a couple of gorgeous miles of vegetation, including cow parsnip, my beloved huckleberries, and bear grass. There was some disagreement in local opinions on whether bear grass was so called because bears like to eat it, especially the blossoms, or because bears use the leaves and stalks to line their dens. Either way, it was right pretty and quite prevalent. We did see a moose cow eating some later in the day, but I would want to collect considerably more data before suggesting we change the name to moose grass. Our progress proceeded relatively unhindered as we strode higher and higher up the side of the mountain valley. We passed a cool woman standing off to one side of the trail on a rock, painting the magnificent view on a small canvas, perched on a little easel. She looked a bit enchanted, like she was always there, greeting passers-by with mirth and mellow vibes. Her mere appearance had me half wondering, why am I not doing that with my life? We came upon a section of trail that featured a tall, sheer rock wall on the right side and a pretty good drop-off to the left of the trail, an extremely dangerous fall, if not lethal. The path was simply a horizontal shelf of the shale and limestone bedrock, maybe 8 feet wide. It felt relatively safe, but would have been undoubtedly safer had it not been for the waterfall, tumbling down the rock wall and splashing across the footpath. The circumstance required carefully placed steps, especially once the ice-cold water began to heavily fall upon you. With calm focus, one at a time, we crossed to safety. I never felt particularly in danger, but a powerful exhilaration at the combination of the waterfall's effects and the potential hazard. Nearing the top of our hike, we were able to look down below us at a view of Lower Grinnell Lake, and it was truly exquisite. The saturated turquoise color, surrounded by conifers, slopes, and mountain peaks, all beneath a cerulean sky patched variably with puffs of cloud, imprinted itself in my memory so effectively that I am still able to recall the exact scene and the shadows of the clouds playing across the lake's surface, rendering it endlessly fascinating to look at. For me, this was the epitome of what John Muir was talking about in his championing of such singular natural scenery. Here was a visual sensation that could only be achieved in this very anomalous and specialized location. Nature is, by definition, all around us, no matter where we are. But here was Mother Nature achieving something exceptional even for her, or so it seemed to us humans. Why is that? I wondered. What is it about this random arrangement of elements, pushed and molded into this particular configuration, that made it so much more glorious to my eye than a seemingly more mundane miracle, like watching a plain old tomato bloom and grow into a delicious, pendulous ball of juice and flavor? While I was photographing the fluctuating light as it dappled the lake, John and George had distanced themselves up ahead a ways. Jeff was engaging in that age-old, unintentional comedy bit of trying to find a spot to safely pee when no one is coming up or down the trail. I know the proper trail etiquette says to get anywhere from 50 to 200 feet away from the trail to water the moose grass, but on these mountain trails, one was lucky to find a safe spot even 10 feet off the path due to the steep terrain. You know how this goes. Every time Jeff would try to fire up the bilge pump, a thru-hiker's head would appear from below, and he would have to uncomfortably halt the stream while pretending to nonchalantly admire some adolescent western larch. Oh, hello, he would assert, like their appearance had startled him from a botanist's reverie. Beautiful, he would add, about nothing in particular. The stranger would pass, and Jeff would resume, working to prime the sump pump once more, only to be thwarted again, and so on. His laments were hilarious, since it was his bladder in peril and not my own. The laughter died out a bit soon thereafter, however, when we arrived at the top of the hike, the so-called Grinnell Glacier. When the fellow, for whom this once enormous mass of ice was named, George Bird Grinnell, arrived in this valley on a hunting expedition in 1885, he looked up and gazed in wonder upon the full 710 acres of the glacier's 19th century breadth. Of course, after a century and a half of slow and then not so slow climate change, that area has shrunk to about 152 acres currently. At the end of the Little Ice Age in 1850, the area that would become Glacier National Park boasted 150 named glaciers. Today, the number of active glaciers has melted down to 25 and continues to dwindle. No matter how bleak the overall story may be, this was our first glacier, and so we were quite taken with it once we stopped and put on our down coats. Observing the remains of the glacier itself, tracing the topographical effects of the glacier and its runoff on the vast entire view, and then straight freaking out at the insane rock formations beneath the glacier filled an hour with wonder and excited exclamations from us like we were a few boys let loose in the woods for the first time. Awesome! You guys, come here! Check it out! It was a lot to take in, and we were glad to then sit down on a comfy rock and put away a bunch of calories. My mainstays were almond butter, beef jerky, string cheese, trail mix, PB&J, and locally baked energy bars. And, as I have said, there's nothing like a chilly spot for a thermos of coffee or tea. The warmth you maintain while hiking can quickly dissipate when you stop. But then when you pause for that needed rest, maybe the nurturing beverage warming your fingers and your belly is well worth the price of admission, and then some. Well rested and fed, we repacked and shouldered our bags to begin the descent. We reapplied sunscreen, especially necessary when walking on or around snow because of the reflection. The fast-moving, heavy clouds and the change in time only served to reinforce the truism that the scenery on the way back down looks like an entirely new route every time. I was feeling the tax of our morning's lengthy climb in my legs, but we took our time with the pace and did our best to land each step gently. You're walking. and you don't always realize it, but you're always falling. With each step, you fall forward slightly and then catch yourself from falling. Over and over, you're falling and then catching yourself from falling. And this is how you can be walking and falling at the same time. Pretty soon, the repeated landings reminded me of this. And never had these Laurie Anderson lyrics rung so true as they did that day. Even the most benign of steps would involve a drop-off of 10 or 12 inches, which meant our knees, ages 49 to 60, were repeatedly catching our entire weight like a shock absorber. Now, if you're a young whippersnapper of 38 or 40, you probably can't yet fathom what I'm talking about. But for those of us over that healthy and plentiful amount of connective tissue hill, well, your knees begin to hurt when you use them thus. Nonetheless, we took it easy so that we could continue walking and falling without it becoming only falling. On the way up, we had crossed a couple of steeply pitched snow fields that were 20 or 30 yards across by digging our boots into the icy snow sideways so that the uphill edge of each boot dug a good grip into the stuff. Taking our time, it was easily done. By the time we had returned to that spot, however, the sun had warmed the mountainside enough that the snow was softer and less ideal for the boot-edge digging technique. John was understandably a bit nervous about sending the three of us across the slope, but we had all exhibited enough capability thus far that he decided we could go for it. Jeff went first, slowly and gingerly bedding his boot edges in the existing tracks from all the morning's previous hikers. The steepness of the hill made it almost possible to keep your left hand, the uphill hand, on the incline as you went, with the ground slanting away drastically downhill. Jeff, therefore, had his Yeti water bottle dangling in his right hand, which seemed like it could become a problem if Jeff should lose his balance and need that hand to stabilize himself. John clearly thought as much as he rushed up after Jeff had taken his first couple of steps and said, "Give me that bottle." I understood John's anxiety, but he probably should have let him be, as it turned out that Jeff's water bottle was actually acting as a sort of counterweight in his precarious balancing of the hazard. We all froze as Jeff wobbled ever so slightly, which was all the wet snowpack needed to fail him and allow his boots to slip out. He slid frighteningly fast on mostly snow and some gravel, handling it coolly, spreading himself out to lower his center of gravity and increase the friction drag on his extremities. Thankfully, he slid to a stop after about 40 feet, and we all shouted words of shock and relief. It was goddamn scary, but just for a few seconds. Jeff was a little shaken up, but quite manageably crossed the lower slope and rejoined the trail a few dozen yards on down. We all hugged him and inspected him for injuries. Nothing broken, but his right knee and shin exhibited what we used to call road rash. They were well abraded and bleeding, like he had wiped out on his dirt bike on pavement. John produced an ample supply of hydrogen peroxide, gauze, and bandage, the immediate value of which was a great endorsement for carrying first aid supplies when embarking upon a ramble. Once the shock wore off and he realized that he was going to survive, it dawned on our mid-tempo troubadour that his defiance of death was yet further evidence that he was the absolute hero of the story of this epic trip. After we helped him wash off his leg and continue back down the trail, he insisted that his achievements, namely the rescue of George's glasses and now this Evel Knievel caliber action, should be celebrated. He should be lionized, he crowed, so much so that he had us wishing that maybe things had gone a different direction back up on the snow slope of death. Soon enough, we came upon the platonic ideal of a tumbling little mountain spring, falling and splashing past us on down the mountain. John was extremely proud of what he was about to announce. You can drink this icy cold, crystal clear glacial melt, as it's literally been frozen for millennia up until today, when it melted and flowed down this valley side. Because we're so close to the source, and the source is so pristine, you can drink from this creek without fear of Giardia. And, meanwhile, as John continued to wax on about the outstanding qualities of the water, I stooped into the small cascade and filled the bowl of my hands to gulp some down. Wow. He was right. Swallowing this unadulterated stuff of life was almost like drinking pure light. I filled my hands a couple more times and splashed my face and beard before stepping away to give someone else a go. John was still extolling the virtues, and I was hardly inclined to disagree. The holiness of the moment was shattered, however, as George drank from his hands and said in a whiny little kid voice, "Mine tastes like sunscreen." We continued heading down the mountain, walking in reverential silence now, out of respect for the religious experience that had been the day's adventure thus far, broken occasionally by Jeff's suggesting good spots to perhaps assemble a plinth or cairn, commemorating his worthy feats. The going was a bit dogged, as the path was rocky, relatively steep, and often wet. One state of affairs that had my attention was the now and again occurrence of small boulders, situated so that they acted as uneven descending steps, which was neat and fun, so long as they were dry. Each step down was like a mini jump, landing one's boot accurately and securely on each stone. When they would sometimes be wet, however, resulting from any of a number of small streams flowing onto the path and then off again, they struck me as potentially treacherous. No sooner had I completed this thought than right in front of me I saw Jeff's boot slide off of just such a boulder, causing his feet to slip right out from under him. His full weight fell onto the offending boulder via his right buttock, and then he toppled from that seated position off onto his side on the ground. It was scarier than the snow tumble because we saw his body sustain what looked like a much more damaging blow. Trying not to panic, we immediately gathered around Jeff. John, to his credit, kept a cool guide's head and knew all the right questions to ask. Jeff maintained an impressive calm as we got his pack off him and he lay across the trail. He asked us to help position him so that his head was below the rest of his body, so we configured him thus that a slightly lower rock would act as a pillow. Breathing deeply to maintain his equanimity, Jeff explained that he suffered from a panic disorder, and to make matters worse, anxiety could cause him to simply pass out cold, due to a condition known as a vasovagal response. His doctor had instructed him to keep his head lower than his body in instances like this, potentially serious injury with a safe outcome yet to be determined, so that the quick drop in blood pressure wouldn't exacerbate his condition, possibly causing a blackout. Mind you, we still had a couple hours of this arduous walking in front of us. I know that John, George, and myself were all pretty worried about the possibility that Jeff wouldn't be able to fully hoof it on his own power. I was already imagining methods by which we could assist him if indeed he did need to be carried out. When John had given us his safety talk at the top of the day, he'd mentioned that in the case of bodily injury, severe enough to require extraction, a rescue chopper could be hours away. So things were slightly tense for a few minutes. Hang on. Everybody just take a breath. Fear not, gentle listener. Let's not forget who it is we're dealing with here. In what seemed like no time at all, Jeff said he felt like he was okay, like we could keep heading down the trail. We helped him to his feet. He made a few jokes at his own expense, like any true hero, and he slung his pack back upon those shoulders that now seemed like they could bear any weight whatsoever that the world might dump upon them. He really did march all the way back down the trail without complaint, and now it was our turn to sing his praises. Our positivity was about 85% sincere, and 15% that parental psych-out, wherein you tell your child, "Wow, what a big, brave boy. You walk the best of all the boys." In the hopes that your Jeff will be convinced to press on, even in the face of minor pain. Eventually, he began to wonder aloud about having any internal injuries from the jarring collision of his body and the small boulder. John explained that from his observations of how Jeff hit the rock, he would most likely end up with only a contused glute, which is a scientific term meaning real sore ass. Jeff replied that he felt like he was in danger not so much physically as psychologically. I thought this was a very healthy example of a person suffering from anxiety using his knowledge and experience to reason himself away from panic. He named his fear out loud to us, his compatriots, and asked us to help him talk himself off the ledge. I don't know about you, but I've certainly had mysterious symptoms upon some night in the past and made the mistake of asking the internet to weigh in on what my condition might entail. Without fail, no matter what variegated details I offered up, the answer always came back, "You'll soon be dead. Please be sure your affairs are in order." I have found it to be quite easy to terrify myself thus, and I don't remotely suffer from anxiety, so I doffed my cap to Jeff for keeping his keel so even. I have hiked a lot of trails in a lot of different places on the planet, but for the time being, when someone mentions anything like getting out into gorgeous nature, it is this magnificent day hiking to the Grinnell Glacier that springs to mind. Grinnell himself and his buddies Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir knew just what they were about when they successfully advocated for the preservation and upkeep of such pristine locations. Just don't ask the Blackfeet. And while I am extremely grateful, I also wonder if there is a way for us Americans to better understand that this heavenly scenery is but a tiny part of the nature in which we live every day. Indeed, the nature of which we are an intrinsic, inseparable part. Chapter 7. Running Eagle Falls. The final feature of our John-curated week presented itself appropriately very much like a dessert. Running Eagle Falls, named after a badass Blackfeet female war chief, the rare woman who led the tribe on buffalo hunts as well as into war, is one of those jaw-dropping, gorgeous displays of the sort of random luck that occurs when running water flows off a decline or hill so steep that gravity causes the water to plummet, forming a water plummet, which was later shortened to waterfall to fit on TLC CD cases, which is a 90s joke, kids. Before we set off on the short walk to the falls, we took the option of traversing a tangential nature walk, a cleanly maintained, handicapped accessible path through a somber forest populated by the charred but still standing remains of moderately tall lodgepole pine trees, peppered with a few white-barked aspens. Our pace had a little more pomp and circumstance to it, since we knew this route was not long or arduous, but that it was our last of the trip. Through the blackened tree trunks, the skyline of the western Rocky Mountains lent a proper sense of grandiosity as we chatted about the week's adventures. The welcoming quality of the nature trail and the falls meant we were back in the realm of simpletons hollering badger and such. But one thing that adheres Jeff, George, and me together is the immediate kinship we feel with people from all walks of life, especially the badger types, because we can never stop knowing that one way or another, we all actually are the badger people. The three of us were all fully forged while matriculating around different parts of Illinois at the less lucrative end of the working class, and we haven't forgotten it. Despite having won the lottery when it comes to earning a living with the talents Mother Nature gave us, we all are still constantly reminded of our failings as humans, a circumstance from which I dare say we draw most of our artistic inspiration. For example, my latest song is entitled "Us Dipshits Gotta Stick Together," or, recalling that brevity is the soul of wit, simply "Dipshits." It's born of the understanding that we're all just doing our best, although we're selfish, clumsy humans, to get through each day with the slightest semblance of grace. With that in mind, I made a habit of greeting people we'd pass on the trail, as did our whole group, by and large. I've been given to understand that this is either a small-town thing or a Midwestern thing, but I'm not positive that's the case. In my little hometown of Manuka, Illinois, even when I was growing up, and everybody truly seemed to know damn near everybody else in our population of around 2,000, there were always people who wouldn't return a wave or a greeting. Taciturn people, recluses, shy people, hustlers and bustlers, as well as our share of assholes, just like any place. It turns out that I have pretty strong feelings about this topic, as I learned when I became a runner about 5 years ago in my neighborhood in the hills of Los Angeles. The varying width of streets, the sharp curves and changes in elevation, and the lack of sidewalks all mean that utilizing these hill streets as a pedestrian can be a dangerous proposition. The speed limit is generally 20 or 25 miles an hour, which seems relatively sedate when behind the wheel, but plenty fast when it's the speed of the oncoming vehicles you're navigating on foot, like a slaloming skater. The frequency with which I greet the people I pass in the street never really occurred to me as anything other than normal. As a kid, not only would one certainly greet your fellow walkers, but one would also wave at fellow drivers, since the odds were good that you knew them. We called this behavior simply being neighborly. A salutation was offered, either vocally or in the form of a gesture, to establish a level of reassurance that we were all in agreement with each other. We wouldn't commit acts of violence against one another, nor hornswoggling or other chicanery. A friendly wave and nod to say, "You're good by me, and I'd like to be considered the same by you, please." 40 years later, in Los Angeles, a city known for being difficult to canvass by foot, I took up running for my health and to manage my burgeoning metabolism. Waistline. As I approached half a century of age, running 4 to 5 miles a day in the hills was extremely gratifying on every level, except when I habitually clicked right back into the apparently pesky old habit of greeting others. You could have blown me over when I began to register the responses from the various motorists. Appropriately, some of them waved, always with some degree of friendliness. Often these greetings would be punctuated by a benign, surprised delight, as if to imply, "Hey, I did not expect a friendly gesture, but man, now that you have sent one my way, I really like it." Or, "Ho, I remember this, just like my mom and dad used to do." Now here's something crazy. These positive responses occurred less than half the time. My estimation would be closer to a third. The remainder of the drivers fell into three possible categories. 1. Eye contact only, no acknowledgement. 2. No eye contact, fully ignoring me. 3. Terrified of my appearance, shrinking down behind the steering wheel out of sight. The eye contact crowd would just infuriate me, because eye contact is a form of engagement. I would wave. They would be alerted so far as to lock eyes with me. Then they would choke. Come on! You just have to do so very little much more. I would wave again, a little obnoxiously this time, to say, yes, you saw right. I greeted you with the universal gesture for, hello, I'm not an asshole. This just drove me up a tree. Another key to successful waving depends on the second wave in any exchange. And that response wave is to say, I'm going to return your gesture so that you don't feel like an asshole for waving. Life is tough, and we're all out here on the road just trying to keep her between the ditches. So, do the math. These drivers, depriving me of their life commiseration, were making me want to feel like some kind of asswipe, but I wouldn't give in to it. These zero eye contact cars were a different vibe altogether. The most generous interpretation of their abject ambivalence was that I truly just existed outside of their sphere, and they literally didn't notice me. They were driving on the section of road that they had been apportioned by the rules of the road, and on the periphery of that paved lane that claimed their focus were shrubs and parked cars and mailboxes and the occasional coyote and me. It was not a very wide road. 3 car widths tops. So the fact that a person could be so zoned out to their surroundings as to miss a good-sized waving man was a tad unnerving. The alternative explanation for the no-eye contactors was kind of the one I'm driving toward, and it's that they just didn't give a shit. In my experience, in modern-day America, we have been encouraged more and more to be the opposite of neighborly. Because there is arguably no demonstrable financial benefit to acting warmly toward our fellow humans. We have been taught it's a dog-eat-dog world and that time is money, so who cares about the neighbors and anybody else? When these cars would pass me by, I would be angered. I would holler, "Suck ass!" or something even more likely to be flagged by standards and practices. Then it occurred to me, hang on, buddy. Don't forget nuance. It occurred to me eventually to think about the other reasons that the drivers might be otherwise occupied than that they were just assholes. What if they had a lot going on, to the point of being stressed out and just barely keeping their shit together? What if they were reciting lines for the audition to which they were speeding? What if it was my Dungeons & Dragons ex-friend Cedric, who says that I'm invisible in real life because he's still holding a grudge after my thief stole his invisibility cloak, his bag of holding, and a vorpal dagger that his cleric had stolen in the first place, so you can still fuck off, Cedric. I know you're listening to this. There was another substantial reason for my snubbing that was staring me in the face once I got over myself for a minute. Many of the drivers were women, and I was a middle-aged white guy with a beard, i.e. a potential danger. I was reminded yet again of the privilege within which I have existed my whole life, in the way that it had never occurred to me to be frightened of any runners I had seen for any reason. Once I started to see them all as fully complicated humans with rich emotional lives, much like my own, I was able to grow less mad at them. Of course, there are still plenty of asswipes. Here's a PSA, just in case any of you or your brothers gets within hearing distance of this audiobook. If you have